Welcome back to Break the Bias, a podcast series hosted by So Perth. I'm Jessica Cook, and I'll be joined today by a new co-host, Jason Balchand, who is our COO. We tapped into this year's International Women's Day theme, and we've been taking the opportunity to speak to some amazing Perth women. And today we're having a chat with Claire Bailey. Claire is a medical doctor who has spent the last 24 months working in the physician training program. And in her spare time, she's involved in the world of musical theatre and has played roles in productions such as Les Miserables. Claire, welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited. I guess my story of getting to where I am today is a little bit different from what you would think. So I'm the daughter of a single mum who I was born over in England. She immigrated out here with me once things weren't working so well. And raised essentially between my mum and my grandparents. Largely grew up down in Bunbury, which is, many of you know, a little coastal town. Fun Vegas or Funbury, as many Vegas, of us yeah. like to
call it. Funbury's the one.
Funbury's the one.
Funbury.
Darrowtown, but we love it. And I guess I had the great privilege of growing up there kind of in country, but not too isolated. And ended up attending both public and private schools there and ended up coming up to Perth for university. Ended up finishing my BA. Bachelor of Arts in History, and then eventually found myself in medicine. But I guess that's a little bit of a more tortuous story. Yeah.
Nice. And so what inspired you to become a doctor as you are now? And can you tell us a little bit more about the physician training program that you're working
in? Yeah, sure. So as a kid, I was never science motivated. I was always interested in science, but I wasn't that classic kind of really strong chemistry, maths kid. I was definitely drama, music, English, history, that sort of thing. And it wasn't necessarily I was bad at them. It's just those things just were far more interesting mm-hmm. to me at, 15, 16 years old when I was making those decisions. Fast forward about 3 years, I'd done a Bachelor of Arts in History at UWA, focusing largely on kind of actually more modern history. So a lot of Australian history actually, couple of Aboriginal history units, some units as well kind of focusing on colonisation of other countries. And it was through that you kind of start seeing how public policy actually massively influences, I guess, the progression of people through time. Started looking more towards public health as a potential avenue and then realised that a lot of the public health programs, when run on ground, are done by nurses and doctors. I had colleagues that were going into postgraduate medicine, and for the first time in my life I thought, what's this thing? You don't actually necessarily need to be the top WACE scorer. At my time it was TEE. You don't need to be the top actually to be getting into medicine after that first degree. Postgraduate medicine was an option. So I started looking at it a little bit more closely and ended up sitting the exam and fortunately just scraping through for the science but excelling at the other 50%, which is a lot of literature reading and interpretation of material, which was obviously a strength. So that's how I ended up there. And then physician training, we're having a little bit of a chat before about kind of what is this in medicine. So physician or a basic physician trainee is someone that's aiming to be a geriatrician or a cardiologist or a respiratory physician. Sometimes a rehab physician is under the same is under my college as well. And for my division, we are purely adult medicine. So if you were to come into hospital, you had a pneumonia, you had a heart attack, maybe you had some weird disease like lupus. Everyone knows lupus from Dr. House. Dr. House is a general physician. So that's what I'm planning to be. And I particularly want to be a geriatrician, which is specialisation in older adult care.
Okay, so you're essentially still, are you still studying or you're so?
Always studying, yeah. Right? Always yeah. Studying, like it hasn't stopped.
And
for
it's
the last
interesting
6 years.
That you came from a kind of literature artsy background going into medicine, because I think the assumption from a lot of people is that you very science maths based.
Yeah, look, honestly, medicine is 80% people
yeah.
and interpretation of people. And One of the reasons I'm still studying is obviously you need quite an extensive science knowledge of disease. And you need a little bit of know-how in that, in terms of you need to know basic kind of physiological processes, and there's a lot of stuff coming out with precision medicine now with immunomodulation and, you know, new chemotherapies and things like that. So that is a part of it. But at the end of the day, for your ultimate exams to become a physician, you need to walk into a room, sit down, be with a patient with an extensively complicated history, and be able to essentially work out of them the things that are most important, the things that are going to have the longest impact in terms of their disease progression, and it's usually social. You know, is this person caring for themselves at home? Are they able to make well-informed decisions? Are they actually able to care for themselves? A lot of our chronic patients really struggle with that because having poor health is really hard. Mm. So it's, I think at the base of it, it's that very human kind of compassionate and I think flexible approach which you need as a doctor, which, you know, can benefit you being a physician.
So the people skills and the bedside manner.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's very underrated by people as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But not by patients.
Not by patients. Yeah, because that's what you want when you go in.
Yeah. Like the patient will remember the doctor that was rude to them or dismissed them or didn't listen or talked over them. You know, those things have lasting effects. They also remember the doctor that was able to say, sorry, I stuffed up. And not necessarily in a negative light either. You know, we know that open disclosure from an early start often completely avoids, I guess, more legislative pursuits down the line if there's been a mistake. The majority of people understand that doctors are just humans as well, but they want you to accept that as well and be ready to say it. Yeah.
100%. And can I ask on a side note before we move into a bit more of the talk, with the musical theatre, I'm interested about that. So what, is that a side hobby? Like, do you still do that?
Yeah, it's like intermittent. I kind of get to take these breaks every couple of years and enjoy it.
What sort of productions have you done?
Oh, so I like to go back to Bunbury and do musical theatre down there. Oh, so as I said, the last one was Les Mis.
Now, wait, is here where I pull up some of the pictures on Facebook and...
Oh, my... Yes, absolutely. But there's no good ones of me as the prostitute. I had a prostitute solo. they gave me that part because it's a prostitute dying of some terrible disease. And they were like, right, the doctor of the chorus gets
Makes
that
sense.
One. Yeah. My mum's a musician. She's a violinist. I grew up around... in particularly the Southwest Opera Company, which is a fantastic group down in Bunbury. They do all the local productions. So it's always been kind of a core part of who I am because it's such a strong community.
Yeah.
And so I really like to get down there and still do things with them every now and then. They've got really, really strong music base down there, you know, wonderful choir, lots of stuff for the kids to do. And so... when the opportunity came up to do Les Mis, I jumped on it. And it's such a good production. It's my favourite one.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. I
actually have never seen Les
Mis. I've never seen it either, but I want to. I've seen the movie, but I haven't
seen it. Oh, the movie doesn't do it justice.
I haven't seen the movie either.
Look, Russell Crowe, bless him, he did an all right job. but you can't beat the stage production. Yeah, it's pretty, no. I mean, it is 4 hours of misery, mind you, but...
Yeah.
And you gotta have a bit of a knowledge of the story before you go in because it's all a bit convoluted, given it's a massive, I mean, like 10-centimeter thick French novel at the start. But
that's how big it is.
Oh, it's massive. Oh, Victor Hugo, yeah.
There you go.
So wrote a couple of essays in there.
So read the novel and then go see the play.
If you're keen. Yeah. No, it's good fun though. Good fun.
Oh,
Sorry, pictures.
So for people listening, well, I'm just looking at the images from...
Let's have a look.
..from her musical theatre. You look great.
Oh,
I love
thank
it.
Thank you. Yeah, that was all down to our wonderful costume designer who essentially went through our
fabulous.
Shed with, you know, 30 years of costume accumulation and redid them all. So it's a massive, as I said, it's a massive community project. That's the thing.
That's so
you're
great.
You're singing and acting with people you've grown up with. So it's very special. Mm. Yeah.
Very, very cool. All right, hitting the hard questions.
Hey.
What we're here for. So you're a proud feminist. You've always been open to talking about issues such as gender equality and haven't shied away from having an opinion. So let's talk about women in medicine and the support and everything surrounding it. Firstly, what really gets your hackles up when it comes to equality? So for us,
for instance,
like, are there certain stereotypes that make you cringe, like the assumption that doctors are men or anything like that, or comments that you receive, that sort of thing?
Yeah, sure. Look, there's everyday stuff that a lot of female doctors would always joke about, or we always do joke about. I saw a Facebook post from a friend of mine who, you know, she did this wonderful recount of she walked past a patient's door and the patient goes, "Oh, doctor," and she's like, "Finally." Then, "I'm not a nurse." They recognise I'm a doctor. She turns around. He says, "Oh, no, can you get the doctor behind you?" Very common. You know, you'll be dressed in civvies, so you'll be dressed, you know, you won't be in scrubs. You'll have a stethoscope around your neck and have a full conversation about treatment. But, you know, some of your older patients, it still won't fly that, "Hi, I'm Dr. Claire," kind of gets missed out of the sentence. Look, that's forgivable. The stuff that really, I guess, if I'm fair to say it, peeves me off, probably the assumptions, and something that I'm encountering more and more about fitting motherhood into specialist training. And it's not the overt, I guess, opinions, but the ones that certainly come from maybe our older colleagues that were raised in a very certain time where you came from school and you went straight into medicine and then you went straight into work, and that was how things went, and there was one doctor in the family and, you know, they were the main provider. The situation has changed significantly now. More and more, we see more women in medicine. I know that the current postgraduate classes are generally actually a 60-40 split towards women. We're increasingly seeing mature age students come in, so men and women that have both had careers in physiotherapy, nursing, maybe as teachers or artists themselves. They're coming in with predefined careers and sets of skills, but also things like families and partners, and not just families, but maybe caring for mum and dad or stepfather or stepmother. And so fitting those things now into the model of healthcare and the way that still, I guess, pervasive ideals about when training should occur, when you should sit exams, you know, where family fits in, some of them are still quite inflexible, and as I said, it's not overt, but it's the sideways comments that can sometimes, I guess, rob your confidence.
That makes sense.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting. We've had a lot of discussions with people we've had on the podcast about that sort of like family dynamic, like even just career-wise, why is it assumed that, you know, the woman should sacrifice career or stay home when the man works? Like it's kind of that, yeah, that bias that,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's the way it is, and most people have like brought that situation up.
Yeah, and look, I think the reality is that our current societal supports are not there. Mm. You know, even within WA government, I was looking at this up just this morning because, as I was saying to Jason, it's become a bit of an, you know, topical issue between my husband and I. I'm looking at maternity leave. What about his, you know, paternity leave? Because I want to be able to go back to work. I want to be able to go back to training, maybe not full time, but certainly part time at least. And so how do we manage that? You know, is he actually going to get any form of paternity leave, or does he absolutely have to be the primary carer in order to take that time off? You know, what kind of compensation does he get, or is he forced to use annual leave? It's actually very hard to find answers to those questions, which is surprising given we're Australia, 2022. You know, it shouldn't be a question. It should be standard. Yep, I know what I've got. Yep. I know what my rights are. We're both government workers. And yet it's something that we're both a little bit unsure about.
Mm, 100%. Like the option for men to take maternity leave should be there.
Oh, absolutely, paternity leave. Absolutely.
In some sectors it is.
Yeah, in some.
So like the university sector, for instance, it's like 9 months or something like that of paid.
Oh, fantastic.
Both paternity and maternity leave, so both get the same thing.
Yeah.
But you'd think by now that would be the same everywhere, especially with government and that sort of thing.
And look, maybe it is. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is there and we just haven't explored it much. But in just being able to access that information, we had a good look this morning. Where do we find that?
Yeah, so it's finding that information that's probably the struggle for most people discussing this sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you alluded to it before when you mentioned about the graduating gender split in postgrad medicine.
Yep.
According to the Medical Journal of Australia, women have had gender parity in Australian medical schools for decades now. However, they represent only 28% of medical deans and 12.5% of hospital chief executive officers. Why do you think there aren't more women in these senior leadership roles?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question. Before we go on, I guess I would say that I think we have seen significant changes in the colleges, at least over the last 5-10 years. You know, increasingly there's a split towards 50-50, which is really encouraging. I know that's for certain in the in my college, in the physicians' college, and also surgical college. Actually, they have some good female representation. But you know. Generally, I mean, even with the surgical college, it's still the CEO and I think the CFO are both male. So those top executive positions, I think it comes back down to, even from the start as children, I always go back to how are we raising our girls, how are we raising our boys, and the different characteristics that we encourage in each. You know, even just looking at my nieces and nephews, the way that we interact with them. My nieces are pulled into the side, they're hugged, they're kissed, so is my nephew, but the things that are encouraged in him are slightly different, you know, those softer, more nurturing sides. Fast forward 20, 30 years when you've come into postgraduate education, or rather the workforce actually, because you're now postgraduate from medicine and starting your journey, the conversations around, you know, fitting in motherhood, which I think, you know, it's fit. Most women will be thinking about fitting that in or family that's pre-existing into your career. Although we see increasing representation, the ability to actually mobilise into those positions, I'm a little bit more sceptical of. I had a recent interaction with one of my supervisors for my college and my training program. And I kind of let them know that I was pregnant. And the comment that I received back immediately was, I'm not sure you're going to be able to finish the training program now.
That was immediate comment.
That was the immediate comment. Why? Because motherhood is a full-time job. You know, you lose momentum. And, you know, the exams I've got to sit are not insignificant. They're very difficult. Yes. But, you know, you lose momentum. What does your husband do? Is he planning to still work? Do you have family to support you? And it's not a big conversation. It's a very private one. But it's also one that made me second guess what my career was. And
but it's also a conversation that doesn't happen if you're male.
It doesn't happen, no. Yeah, you're quite right. And I guess the thing is I could have walked away from that conversation and gone, well, maybe this isn't suitable for me. Maybe this specialist training, which would ultimately elevate me into a lot of different positions, isn't the right choice for me. Maybe I should consider general practice, which is generally seen as being more female friendly. Although you'll see a recent article, the amount of burnout in female GPs and the suicide rate is untenable, essentially. And so you've got to wonder how much of those small conversations, those small, I guess, sideways remarks about exams, making it, getting through, you know, prevent women from continuing the programs or finishing their training. Or even bigger things like, I mean, when you're a basic physician trainee and you're working full time, they're incredibly long hours sometimes. Yep. I have a friend that almost, you know, she was almost due to do 72 hours on call. How do you continue to function with that, you know? Unfortunately, patients don't stop being sick at 5 o'clock. So if you're the main person on the ward, and someone's deteriorating, then you don't go home at 5. You go home at 6 or 7 whenever the stuff is sorted out. So that can be a preventative for not only a lot of women, but a lot of men who don't want to be away from their families, you know, until 8 o'clock in the evening, just, you know, randomly. So, you know, there's personal interactions and there's systemic things that I think ultimately probably push some people away, provide additional pressures, or at least aren't supportive in terms of women accelerating into those roles. Because how do you become a CEO while also, you know, being expected to be a mum?
Well,
you know, you know, and also being a clinician most of the time. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a bigger, it's a big conversation, but it's certainly one that's multifaceted, I think.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm hearing is that the framework for a leadership position like that is just not good enough to be flexible for women who want to be a mum and have that role.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's interesting because my college has made provisions for that. They've allowed, you know, I'm in part-time training now, I'm in part-time work, largely because I just went straight to medical workforce and asked for a part-time contract.
Yeah.
So those systems theoretically are there. But whether they're actually encouraged on the ground is a different thing, or whether they're supported on the ground is a different thing. I mean, WA, it's even more difficult now. WA is at a significant junior doctor shortage, significant. We relied very, very heavily on the UK for a lot of our doctors.
Okay.
We probably didn't make provisions for training more doctors early enough. You know, and even then we don't have training positions necessarily for them to go into. So let alone adding COVID to that, it becomes very dire and it becomes very hard for someone that's burning out to say, sure, we can give you part-time. I think I got very lucky with that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're getting there. But
getting there slowly. Yeah.
Definitely.
And it is evolving more and more.
Yep.
As I said, you know, more and more you see the colleges come out with these flexible training policies, but it's about being able to enact them on the ground and actually support people through them, you know.
And with borders opening now, and I'm assuming we're going to start seeing more international doctors coming in.
Absolutely.
Is that going to have a big impact and help that situation?
Yeah, look, generally, I hope I'm not wrong in saying that the majority of the doctors we'll get through will probably be from the UK. I can imagine a lot of our hospitals will be doing a lot of, promo over that way, particularly our private sectors, which have been hit particularly hard with junior doctor shortages. And UK doctors are very easy to get through into our Australian system because they essentially come with general registration. We immediately recognise their training as equivalent to our own. Some of our other international medical graduates, like who might have been trained in Malaysia or Singapore or even some of the Saudi Arabian or old Eastern Bloc countries, which often cater, they often find it a lot harder to get through. They have to go through ARPA and gain general registration by demonstration of skill sets and reports and things like that. So a small subset of them, I imagine, will be coming over, but it's very stressful for them actually coming through and dealing with our regulatory agency. It's a very long-winded process.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
But it's good. It's going to be good to see like what the impact is on
more
labour, not just in medical fields, but in general,
because
there's a labour shortage across the board at the moment. So,
oh, absolutely.
That's another long conversation.
Amen. Hey?
So, what do you think would make the biggest? If you had to pick one thing, what do you think would make the biggest change in the push towards gender parity in medicine?
Look, it's a bit, I guess, esoteric or it's a bit fluffy, but I think accountability on the ground is the big thing. I mean, it's a bit of a shame that person I had that conversation with is pretty much my main contact in terms of my training. You know, I have mentors as well that I guess are less involved, and thankfully they're kind of the ones that kind of keep you going and prop you up and give you confidence. But that accountability on ground in line with maybe what our colleges or our AMA or our, you know, wider organisations a touting or shouting is what I'd hope to see. We talked initially about, or kind of glossed over a bit of the gender quotas as well, which are increasingly seen. I think there was the Victorian AMA branch.
Yeah, so AMA Victoria back in 2019 changed its constitution to ensure 40% gender quota on its board, which I think is huge.
I think that's fantastic. And I think, you know, some people might think, oh, 40, not enough. Why isn't it 50-50? But then we do have to remember there's generally been a 40-40-20 quota as well, you know, the 20% accounting for people that maybe don't identify as male and female. And I think that has to be there as part of the conversation moving forward.
And it's a starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. So gender quotas, I think, have a good way of starting it. And maybe, you know, as some of that becoming formalised in some of our colleges, some of our wider AMA branches can go a long way. We know that gender quotas essentially fast track people into the positions. And I think I was thinking about it this morning because, you know, I think there's this kind of verbalisation, well, you know, if people really wanted the job, they'd go for it and they'd make themselves available. But I think what introducing a quota does is makes them look at the system and goes, okay, well, if we don't have someone for the job or if we don't have someone stepping up, why is that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do we have to change about the system around it to make sure that's a viable option, you know, to support people coming into these roles rather than making the work of the individual in a massive cogwheel of different machinations to actually figure out how to make the time amongst everything else.
Yeah, you know? And I guess the other trouble is the unconscious bias side. So I've been involved in several board discussions throughout my career where we've been recruiting or the board's been recruiting new members and typically the board recruitment process is very, very biased without them even knowing it and it's recommendations from within the board of people that they want to join the board. So you get more people that look and think like the people who are already on the board. And if you have a board of old white males, most of the recommendations are going to be more old white males.
Yeah, yeah. I think wasn't there something came out of Monash recently? I think all the honorary doctorates or something like that. It was just a line of six white old men all above 50. Mm. It was a little bit embarrassing for them. But I think exactly right. Like for like, isn't it?
Yes.
You know? And I think, I mean, that extends to race equality as well.
It extends across the board.
And looking back, you know, such a white group we were, you know, coming through postgraduate medicine.
And it's not representative of what the population looks like either.
No, absolutely not.
Like I think it was you I sent a couple of weeks ago. There was a company that was talking about how they champion diversity, equity and inclusion, and it's one of their values and it's something they is in everything they do.
Mm.
And I looked up the senior management team and board, all white males.
Oh, wow.
And
isn't that interesting?
A company that's significantly promoting and saying that they are all about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and yet the management team doesn't actually reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you say that a lot, though. But, yeah, I think you raised a really good point before about, you know, looking at why people don't want to go into those roles. I think that's an interesting point. And break the bias isn't just for women.
No,
it's for
the
minorities. It's for race. It's for, you know, people like non-binary people, people who don't identify as a gender. So it can be applied across everything.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
And everyone needs to be part of the conversation too.
Yeah. I'm really excited to see what it will look like in 20, 30 years. Because I think the conversation around diversity has absolutely exploded, I think, with even in the last 5 years.
Yes.
You know, I think back to when I was just coming out of medical school, having a placement in the sexual health clinic. We were having discussions around non-binary and that was extremely new, incredibly new, you know, how to deliver testosterone or estrogen to children that are maybe identifying as non-binary, what are the ethics around that? Whereas now, non-binary is just part of the conversation. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's great. Like that's
fantastic.
Yeah.
And it has just rocketed. Yeah. And the visibility of trans people, the visibility of people of colour and the conversation about how that feeds into our culture has just absolutely exploded. I think a lot of it has to do with social media.
I was just
streams of TikTok where you can have these amazingly just visual and engaging, snippets of information and visibility. That's the thing, a person in your phone that looks and identifies like you, and that's not the way that you were told at 3 years old, you know, amazingly powerful.
It's given everyone a platform to amplify their voice.
Not always for the best.
But yeah. I think the good does outweigh the bad most of the time.
Most of the time, yeah. It's a complex conversation. I mean, the reliance on technology is something as well, because, of course, when you get those little snippets, you get a nice little dopamine and serotonin hit, which is incredibly addictive, and that's a different story. But, yeah, the power of individual story coming through these platforms is immense. Yep. Yeah,
definitely. And speaking of 20, 30 years' time, how are you hoping that you can impact the world and make things easier for the next generation?
Oh, thanks for asking that. Even before coming on that, I was thinking about it, particularly in the context of the conversations I've been having with people about training and what I want to do. I would hope that I would be finished and that I would be a geriatrician, like I hope. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to be in some kind of role which oversees education and training for other young doctors, and hopefully providing some of those supports which, you know, I've had intermittently and found invaluable in my own training. You know, continuing that conversation, I think, about promoting diversity and equality, and I guess remaining open to the way that society changes, being one of those people that remains open to new ideas within medicine. Mm. I'm probably very Bachelor of Artsy background for that. You know, that very much informs those original kind of values and things that I studied right back at the start of my university career still really inform the way that I want to see medicine change and evolve. Because it's a very diverse profession, but ultimately, as I said, very human. And so you really have to be able to look after both patient and doctor in that relationship.
Yeah.
It can be a bit difficult sometimes. But
yeah, it can be.
I'd like to be in a supportive role in that way.
Yeah. Amazing, yeah. And so this year's International Women's Day theme was Break the Bias, and that's the title of our podcast as well. What does that mean to you, Break the Bias?
I think much of what I said before, remaining open to different ideas. And I think really pushing for systemic change. You know, continuing to push the idea of men in the home or women at work in whatever the capacity that they want to be, whether that's with children, without children, you know, and not having a judgment on that. You know, what we will see in a few more years, which is acceptance of people that are not gender identifying and how they will fit into the workplace and supporting them in their what will be sometimes difficult interactions with patients that maintain those biases. I think certainly in health and medicine that's going to be the way forward. And I think approaching each with compassion. Compassion and open-mindedness, I think that's probably Break the Bias for me.
And I think that I think a lot of people kind of look at the future and think that things aren't going to change, but I think that things are. Like we can kind of, you know, talk about the negatives here, but I think there are a lot of positives as well coming out of things.
Oh, there are a lot of positives, like you said before, with the conversation being a normal now versus several years ago it was not heard of. So like we have made a lot of positive progress over the years.
As I said, it's exciting times in many ways. It's just kind of I'll be so interested to I wish I could cast into the future in 20, 30 years and see what
Wouldn't
it was
Wouldn't that be
like.
Nice?
That would be really nice.
If we all
what are those
that?
Lotto numbers?
Yeah. Maybe a bit scary as well. We've got other kind of climate issues on the background as well. But
yeah, so that's a whole other topic. I do want to see the future.
Hopefully we can be resilient.
We will. We'll evolve. We always have. It's not always the best option, especially when we can actually make changes now that mean we don't have to have those options. But all we can do is what we can do.
That's it.
So you've mentioned that you were brought up by your mum and your grandparents. Who are some of the other women who have inspired you throughout your journey?
I think my Year 12 science teacher, Cherry Cowan. Thanks, Miss Cherry Cowan. She was great because she really encouraged the questioning in me or the curiosity in me. I was always the kid that was poking things in science class before they were ready, you know.
That was me as well.
Yeah. And she said she just, it was an offhand comment from her, but she said, you know, that's good. You know, keep
curiosity
doing that.
Curiosity is always good. We need to encourage curiosity everywhere.
Yeah. She was always so positive about it and really a really positive person in the classroom as well. And that, for whatever reason, that one flyaway comment, you know, really stuck with me and gave me a lot of, you know, courage, I think, when I was now, you know, changing from art to a science background. I thought, oh, well, she saw something in me. And then I think other female role models, they tend to be actually female physicians. I had a great mentor over at one of the hospitals I was working, Dr. Maria Foundas, who's a geriatrician herself, beautiful with all her patients, wonderful with the students. And you know, at the time, I think, I hope she wouldn't mind me saying this, took a course that wasn't usual because she had her first child, I think, just after she'd finished. We kind of had basic training, then we have advanced training, and she had her child just after finishing advanced training. And it took her many years to actually become, you know, qualified as a physician as she continued to have her children, which I don't think was really the done thing at the time. You know, it was still kind of a little bit unusual, but she did it and she managed through. And now she plays a very significant role at that hospital as both a mentor and a clinician, and has done for many years. So it's those people that are, I guess, quite, and she's just one of many, actually, you know, women that, you know, you look back on and actually 20 years ago they were kind of making marks or taking those first steps to pave the way for people like me now, make it much more acceptable to do what I want to do. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, she's a cool lady.
All right, so final question, and it's a biggie. So this Saturday we're headed to the polls for a federal election. And I know you're politically
inclined.
Regardless of who's elected, because like the predictions are, it's going to be a hung parliament. What are you hoping to see our next elected parliament do over the next 3 years to create a better, more equal society? It's a big one.
It is a big one because I think our current expectations are pretty minimal for one side and pretty big for the other.
Yep.
So what would I hope that they do in terms of gender equality specifically?
Just in general to make a more in equal society. Like maybe it's gender equality, maybe it's equality in general.
Look, so both are potential leaders, obviously both men.
Yep.
I would hope that the comments about "I know because I'm a father" stop.
Yep.
You should know just because you are a friend of women.
Because you're human.
Yeah, not just because you're a father and a husband.
Yep.
You know, that doesn't give you clout. Mm-hmm. It just is the way things that many things are.
Empathetic human is all you need to be.
Yeah, yeah. So a little bit of a change in savvy from that point of view would be nice.
Yep.
Look, moving forward, for me, actually, the biggest conversation is about health, but actually probably one of the things that's stuck out in my mind is in terms of our nursing ratios and things like that. That's become a big question. And it's actually it's also a gender equality issue, because we know that the majority of our aged care workers and our nurses are female.
Yep.
It's not always the case. We have amazing male nurses, and the retention of male nurses is increasing. But the fact that it is one of our lowest paid sectors with the highest stress, actually it's a very high labour sector. The turning of a patient that weighs over 100 kilograms requires three people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is physically hard work, that and which is always under-recognised. I would hope that regardless of who comes in, that there is actual proactive measures to improve the current under shortages of staff, to upskilling staff that is necessary across both hospitals and the aged care sector. Yeah, that would be my main hope. And I think, you know, obviously the conversation of COVID has brought that to the forefront, you know, people realising actually how woeful
it
is. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realise that our aged care homes do not have nurses. They have aged care workers, which is very different.
Yep. You have one or two registered nurses and the rest are either ENs or just carers.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
You don't necessarily have a doctor. You might have a doctor that's on call, that's a GP, but you don't have someone that's necessarily going to come out and assess a whole bunch of patients if they're sick. Mm. You know, there's a real, I think, lack of clarity actually around that sector. And it's unfortunate, because there's a lot of blaming when people become unwell or conditions are really bad. But a lot of these people in these sectors are working really, really hard. A lot of them being women, many women from overseas, I might add, in these low-paid jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not well supported, and they haven't been well supported through COVID.
Yep.
So I think that will be part of the conversation moving forward, hopefully.
Definitely. I mean, there's always been conversation around, you know, nurses don't get paid enough and aged care don't get paid enough. And there's been promises before.
They really, really don't.
Yeah.
No. I think one thing that people have to remember when they go into hospitals is that, you know, nurses really are the frontline workers, more so than doctors, actually, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
Because when a patient maybe is confused, delirious, they might be 75 years old with advanced dementia but incredibly physically strong.
Mm-hmm.
So if they become aggravated or agitated, you know, and it's one nurse to a six patient ratio, how are they meant to handle that? Mm. You've got a doctor that's meant to be on the ward but is actually seeing someone else two wards away. That's incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
You know.
And like difficult
and
as
dangerous.
Well, yeah.
Mm.
So the realities of actual work for a lot of these people is a lot harder than people imagine. So, yeah, they don't get paid enough.
Yeah.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, it's I think it's such a big discussion, though. What do we do to fix our healthcare system?
And
the scary part is we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world.
Yeah, we do, to a degree. Still lacking in some areas.
Yes.
I mean, again, the need for upskilling, the need for retention of nurses. I remember, maybe 6-7 years ago, where there was a freeze on hiring nurses in Western Australia.
Mm.
A whole bunch of graduate nurses could not get training programs to actually get their accreditation to work as registered nurses. I'm not sure what happened there, but, you know, here we are.
Mm.
And we're six nurses down in an ED on a night makes a big difference.
And add COVID into that as well, where you've got nurses like out.
Oh, I was literally watching a news story about this last night.
It's crazy. Yeah, no one could have predicted this, I think. But at the same time, it was, you know, we've been under pressure for a while.
Yeah.
Mm, we're just very lucky it didn't hit us as hard as it did in the beginning.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah.
Something that our politicians have actually done very, very well and sort of very, very much limited our exposure to COVID, and, like, we've come out of it a lot better than what we
did. I think WA has been incredibly fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Incredibly fortunate.
Definitely.
Yeah. I remember 2 years ago when when Italy was first becoming affected, and we were very frightened at that stage because we simply didn't have enough ventilators in the state. Trying to figure out how quickly we could acquire the ventilators we needed, and, you know, and how quickly they would be manufactured and shipped and things like that. It was a very scary conversation. Mm-hmm. So, know.
And also just like the unknown of what COVID was and how big a deal it was actually going to be.
Who would have thought when we first heard about it in China we'd be here,
Yeah. Contagion, still the best movie ever.
Yes.
And that skyrocketed once this movie happened. Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of a bit eerie to watch it at that time. But
definitely. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on today, Claire.
Oh,
it's been great
so
to chat and hear all your views and get to know you a bit better.
Thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.